Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is The Compliance Guide.
The Compliance Guide.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is The Compliance Guide. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of The Compliance Guy. It is Monday, November 13th. We are live on multiple streaming platforms. And as always, I am happy, excited, ecstatic to introduce my very good friends, Terry Fletcher, Scott Kraft, Christine Hall, Stephanie Howard, and Paul Spencer, in no particular order. Just because I said your name first doesn't mean you're my favorite. And just because I said your name last doesn't mean you're my least favorite. I like you all the same. Favorite. All right. So we've been off, 2 weeks? So after a two-week hiatus, we are back. We have a great episode because there's so much to talk about. But I want to start first with you, Stephanie, because I don't think we ever do. And I want to talk about what's going on with this particular G-code and what is it based on your analysis of this code and your engagement with clients that leads you to believe somehow, some way, it could potentially turn to fraudulent billing.
Yeah, so today I wanted to focus on the code that we have starting in 2024, the G2211. So a couple of kind of, caveats here that we need to talk about first is that because it's so new, we don't know all of the nuances that are going to come into play here. I myself just starting to research this particular code and not finding a lot of information. Before I get into the specifics of my research, let me just give a little background here. So G2211, I believe, was first introduced in 2021. And then CMS at the time had said that we're going to wait and we're finally having the implementation of reimbursement for this starting January 1st of 2024. Now, as I just stated, let's highlight here real quick that it is a CMS-based code. So one of the things that we're going to have to pay attention to is looking to see what the commercial payers are going to do with this. And the purpose of this G code is to be able to report additional work for patients that are complex. I'm seeing all throughout the material right now references to language of longitudinal care, meaning, you know, extended complex care for long services of time or spans of time is probably a better way to say that. So my fear before I even dug in and started researching is that this is going to become something like we saw during the pandemic, where people are noticing that there's a new code available or something that will now be reimbursed. And it's just added across the board. I'm sure a lot of you are seeing, especially if you follow on LinkedIn, a lot of information coming out about the cuts in reimbursements to the fee schedule. So, you know, to me, what I'm thinking of right away is this G code is going to be thought of as the main solution to everything to help with that area of reimbursement. As I started to dig in, one of the things that's interesting is that we don't have a lot of information as of today. CMS has it in their, you know, their notifications that this is going to start, but they're not digging in yet. The MACs, I always like to go to Novitas because they're a very thorough MAC. We don't have information yet as to how this is going to work. So one of the things I wanted to talk about today on the panel and get everybody's thoughts are, you know, from a documentation perspective, what is this going to look like? One of the other things, too, I think we should talk about is when it's referring to caring for patients who are complex in that long-term care, what is this going to look like for specialists? You know, a lot of the information is looking like the intent of this is for internal medicine. Do we have that in black and white writing? Absolutely not. There's a lot of subjectivity that exists here. So, you know, going through the panel today, I just thought we could talk about specialties and then what you're thinking from a documentation perspective. One other thing before we throw this around here, for myself, I can't help but link it in my mind to what we dealt with the add-on code for COVID. I can't remember if any of you do, if it was, you know, 99072 or whatever that added supply code was, or ancillary staff time. But constantly when I audit charts for that, I never see any additional documentation supporting that. So, you know, I think one of the base messages today is going to be that this is not something that can be left to assumption because you're internal medicine, because you're managing patients for comorbidities. You know, these conditions that are not going away. So, Christine, do you want to go ahead and tackle that first?
I think Terry had a comment that she wanted to, and then absolutely, I got a lot on this that I got some thoughts. Maybe not a lot,
thank
but I got
you.
Some thoughts.
Yeah, so I was looking at this and I had to find it in the final rule because I really wanted to research this, mainly because, as I think Stephanie mentioned, we're also dealing with the budget neutrality rule. So remember, this code, one of the reasons they put it on hold during the pandemic is because it was going to pull from the reimbursement for other codes. So they don't add something without taking away from somewhere else, which really kind of sucks. No way to put that professionally. That's just awful, just how that works. But if you're looking as a resource or a reference, the final rule, page 432, or the final rule, page 429, it talks about the clarification that Medicare put out, or CMS put out, I should say. And they talked about the specific examples and conditions that would not require the add-on code. And one of them said like a mole removal, because remember the key phrase is longitudinal care. So it's something that you have to really deal with for a long time. And for some reason, CMS believes that that's primary care, which I understand. I mean, I'm a consultant for AAFP, so I understand that. But when you're dealing also with pulmonary or cardiology or internal medicine, there's also specialty physicians that are going to look at this and say, wait a minute, I've got a CHF patient. I've got a coronary artery disease patient. I've got this longitudinal patient. So I think we're going to see a lot of, this is going to be billed a lot more than they anticipate. But they talk about when not to bill it. One was mole removal, treatment of a simple virus, allergies, new onset of GERD, which is esophageal reflux, treatment for fractures, because again, those are things that you see a patient for, you fix it. You don't have to, you know, ongoing care. But there's a couple of things to be mindful of, and I don't think a lot of people read into this, and this was on the final rule. First of all, if you bill on the same date as a visit, plus also, and actually somebody else said oncology, absolutely, and also a procedure, let's say minor procedure with a 25 modifier. Anytime that 25 modifier comes up, they will not pay for it. So it has to be with an E&M code add-on without a 25 modifier claim. And then the other thing that I think was interesting is they said CMS expects that G2211 will be billed with 38% of all E&M services initially and 54% of all E&M services when fully adopted. But they don't seem to think it's going to be a lot. It's going to be billed that much. I personally think it's going to be more like 70%. I think it's going to get out of control. Stephanie, did you read that and think 38%?
I expect 100%. I just think clients, the way I see things, it's a new code. They cut reimbursement. We get extra here across the board, 100%.
I think so too.
We're going to see.
And I think what people don't understand is the documentation intensity that you're going to have to support this, and I think this can be a great segue for Christine, is that how many level fours, and actually, Sean, you were excluded on this because I knew you were out of town, but I sent to the panel a level four that came from E&M University, which is that site that, you know, online that gives the examples and training on how to do E&M. And I said, this is what they're calling a level four. You know, it's less than, you know, 75 words. And I was just surprised because all of us had a different opinion. I thought it was level three. I know some of you thought it was level four. And so, Christine, I'll send it over to you at this point. I could see our stable chronic patients that they do nothing for except, you know, continue meds, and all of a sudden that they're like, well, that's longitudinal because I have a patient who's hypertensive. So, you know, that I'm monitoring on meds. Go.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that the consolidated, so it was originally proposed in 21, and it was the Consolidated Appropriations Act that came in and said, whoa, because they even said, we're expecting 90% of providers to use this additional code, which is going to throw out budget neutrality, and we're going to have to start taking money from other places. So what would be the point? If we have to take the $20 or $25 away from an E&M visit, then what's the point of adding a G2211 if, you know, eventually it's going to come out in the wash anyway, because we know that you know, traditionally providers have a tendency to overutilize new codes when they come out, especially when there isn't specific guidance, like in this case, that we don't have that specific guidance. We later on, when the guidance comes out, you'll see a lot of backpedaling happening, and it'll become part of the audit circuit. And just like we're seeing now with all of the COVID modifications that were made, that nobody had an idea early on what that was supposed to be. So I think people need to really think about this when their doctor comes flying in the office and says, everybody gets a 2211, right?
Yeah, listen, here's the thing. And I'll just go back to simple talk, right? Anytime a new code comes out and it becomes a top revenue generator for an organization, the payers know what you're doing even before you do. And being an outlier, having an aberrance in your coding pattern for something, one, where there's a high rate of subjectivity. Two, there's a lack of guidance on the use of this code. I think we all know what longitudinal means, but I think when we start talking about longitudinal from a documentation standpoint and what's actually required, it becomes interesting. And I'll share something with you. Obviously, you know, I got to be careful about what I say, because, you know, it's still going on. But in a case that I was part of, one of the things that was brought up was, are evaluation and management service codes or other codes subjective, to the point where if you were to take one piece of documentation and put it in front of multiple coders or multiple auditors, would you get varying opinions on it? And the answer is undoubtedly yes. Because certain services are left wide open to interpretation. You know, the guidance documents that exist in a lot of cases are ambiguous at best. So, you know, I think whoever said it, Christine or Terry or Stephanie, you know, the fact comes down to when a provider comes in and they are rip roaring, ready to go because there's a new HCPCS level 2 code or a new CPT code that they believe is going to generate a whole bunch of money for you, tell them to just take a deep breath. Let's take a look at it. Let's see what guidance is out there. And then the smart thing to do, from my perspective, is to create a policy. Because in the absence of definitive guidance from a payer or from the federal government on how you should be documenting and billing for something, if you create a policy that says, because of the lack of official guidance from AMA, CMS, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, whoever it is, our organization's opinion and interpretation of the definition of this HCPCS code is as follows. Remember, if you're ever going into court to defend your organization for billing certain services, you can't go in and say, well, we've always done it that way. That's our policy. if you have a smart defense counsel who's cross-examining, you know, somebody, or you have a smart prosecutor who's cross-examining somebody, they're going to say, well, do you have that policy in writing? And if you say, well, no, that's just how we've always done it. Well, folks, if you don't have written policies and procedures, you don't have policies and procedures. You can't go into a courtroom and start making stuff up. It doesn't work that way. So Terry was kind enough to, you know, give me the pages as to where this is posted. It is in the final rule. And to Terry's point, as with most things, it got buried. So you need to look at pages 428 through 445. You can also look at the Federal Register 85, and it's from 84570 and then 84571. All right. So Scott, Paul, let me come to you guys because you've been patiently waiting. Paul, I know you were out last week. We were all raising a cheer to you for your well-being and healing of your shoulder surgery. So it's good to see you, buddy. You're not allowed to be off of work again for another 5 years.
Thank you. And my forever dream of that exploding Steve Carlton slider is now dead in the water.
All right.
So as it applies to G2211, I mean, there are two things that need to be considered. First of all, the documentation for this is not simply going to be the typical documentation that you're going to see in an assessment and plan for a single serious condition or complex condition. What they're looking for is something, you know, and I'll use the words of a recent coding alert. They're looking for, you know, the purpose of the code is to encourage holistic, patient-centered care that involves collaboration and coordination across specialties and provides continuity and consistency in patient care. CMS believes that the code represents the practice expense involved in that sort of care. So realistically, I mean, it's a lot of empty words, but from a documentation standpoint, your simple assessment and plan of, oh, they have this serious condition, and these are the things that I did, and you know, this is why I'm going to build G2211, are not going to be sufficient enough. There really needs to be, it needs to be broken out what that serious condition is. Because remember, when you're dealing with a patient such as me that has the big three of chronic conditions that you have to break down and have to be assessed at a 4-month interval, it's not enough to just say, yeah, stable, continue current meds. I mean, that's just not going to cut it. There needs to be definitive documentation about the medical steps that you took in order to address that serious condition or complex condition that you claim you're eating up resources treating.
You know, Paul, I wonder if the payers, you just brought up an interesting point. I wonder if they'll ever, Medicare, I should say, since the Medicare code, I wonder if they'll look to see if that patient's enrolled in care management. Because if they're chronic care management, that seems like that's a longitudinal type service where, yes, you've got chronic conditions, but people always forget the criteria. Those are patients that could deteriorate, could be rehospitalized. You know, we're trying to avoid that from happening. And so they're monitored outside of the office. And I'm wondering if that could be an indicator that it's appropriate for that code.
That's a fantastic point. And the first thing I want to do is run bundling edits between chronic care management and G2211.
I didn't even think of it until you said it. Yeah.
You know,
absolutely. And, you know, Pam Vanderbilt, I agree with her. You know, this very well could be a code that shows up on every single claim that doesn't have a modifier 25 attached to it.
But Sean, clarify, we don't want to see it on every claim.
No. And I think that's what Pam is saying. She's saying, pay attention, everybody, because this is probably something that is going to become abused.
A problem. Yeah.
And again,
that's a lead pipe cinch. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I was going to say, I wish I could bet on that.
I know.
Yeah. Listen, I think, you know, Scott, you know, you're one of the most cerebral thinkers that I know. And I mean that in the, you know, the most complimentary context, right? You know, I think what needs to happen is people need to understand, how can you legitimately document longitudinal care to be able to support a service?
You know, I'll tell you, I think a lot of this has to do with, at least in part of it that I'll get to in a second, how the nature of the primary care relationship is captured on a visit-to-visit basis, including the understanding of the relationship with the patient, how they may follow guidance, how it's influenced. What scares me about this is the vagueness of it. And I want to talk about a couple of things here, and I'm going to read the code descriptor. So, visit complexity inherent to evaluation and management associated with medical care services. Here's the important part: that serve as the continuing focal point for all needed healthcare services and or with medical care services that are part of ongoing care related to a patient's single serious condition or complex condition. So it almost carves out these two different, when you think about the and or, to me, it opens up the door for the idea that, like, if I'm a specialist and I'm managing one complex serious condition, I'm able to use it. But if I'm the primary care provider who's seeing the patient on an ongoing basis, potentially I could use it as well. And to further complicate matters, there's an example in the fee schedule on page, I believe, 429 that talks about sinus congestion. And so it comes in and says, you know, and I'm trying to find the exact wording of it. This is, bear with me here. We clarify that it's the relationship between the patient and the practitioner as the determining factor. First, the continuing focal point for all needed healthcare services describes a relationship between the patient and the practitioner, where the practitioner is the continuing focal point for all healthcare services that the patient needs. For example, a patient has a primary care practitioner that is the continuing focal point for all healthcare services, and the patient sees this practitioner to be evaluated for sinus congestion. The inherent complexity that this code captures is not in the clinical condition itself, but rather the cognitive load of the continued responsibility of being the focal point for all needed services for the patient. And I won't keep reading. Everybody can look it up for themselves, but it goes on to talk about, you know, the practitioner recommends conservative treatment. Some patients may think the doctor's not taking the patient's concerns seriously. So it's all about this sort of vague back and forth around a condition that, you know, for a lot of us on an acute basis is unpleasant, but isn't necessarily meeting that guideline of this notion of a, quote, serious condition. So I don't think they do themselves any favors with that. And I think for me, when I read that, I started to think about, well, how can I capture from an individual note the nature of an ongoing longitudinal, thank you. This is why I was not a sea captain. I can't, you know, like, how are you trying to capture that in the context of, like, one single acute condition? Because on the one hand, they talk about these things that, you know, we all think of as fairly acute, straightforward mole removals, that kind of thing. But, you know, if I'm going to my primary care doctor now and I'm talking about mole removal, or I have a mole and the primary care doctor is focused on the fact that I'm, you know, resistant to treatment, I don't always follow guidance, does that make it a G2211 case? And I found that section particularly interesting because it felt like it sort of propped the door open to just about any primary care relationship that isn't a one-off relationship.
Well, Scott, you know, yep. One thing I think is interesting, because when Sean said you're a cerebral thinker, for those of you that don't know Scott personally, if you ever want something written for a paper, he's the person to go to. Sorry, Scott, I just opened the door.
Thank
there.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Here come the emails.
I know, right? But to me, you're like the person who programs AI. Seriously, I go to you and say, okay, I'm trying to get this through. And you give me the language that not only cracks me up, but it just makes more sense than how I think I would put it. But that brings up AI. And I'm thinking, this type in longitudinal, and oh my gosh, I just, my head just exploded. I think I need to move on. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, well, What we're going to end up seeing, and you know, one of my sort of concerns that I'm not quite sure how to solve with the 2021 guidelines in general is the number of times that the provider's documentation simply repeats what the guidelines are, right? So this is an acute complicated condition, and I'm just going to say that rather than defining it, right? And so, you know, I think with this, we end up with macro statements that, you know, this medical decision making is reflective of my long-term relationship with the patient, right? Does that?
I hear that, you know, all the time.
I'm saying something, but yeah. I'm saying nothing at the same time. And there was a comment here from a user. The example I made reference to was, I believe, on page 4. It looks like when you open the giant 2,709-page file, it appears to be particularly on page 439. That's the sinus congestion conversation. So I think if you open up the rule and you search sinus congestion as one phrase, you'll probably find it pretty quickly.
All right, Sean, we beat that dead horse.
Well, I think, before we go, though, I just want to say that the thing with the macros really, really, really bothers me. I think providers need to remember that those macros are not intended to be the answer. They're intended to assist providers in reporting more patient-specific information. So they should be going in and adjusting those macros to be patient-specific. The word longitudinal doesn't tell us anything. Could it be that, you know, because of the increased thought process to make sure that the patient's hypertension, diabetes, and hyperlipidemia are considered in the management of blah, 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 that's more patient-centered. To just say something is because it meets what the impression was given in the original instruction, just to use that as a macro. I mean, that's what a lot of these audits are resulting in, overpayments, because the macro is just, I mean, I saw one the other day that was in the physical exam, his, her prostate uterus was examined today.
Oh no. Like, oh no. They're supposed to be prompts. They don't understand. They're not supposed to be verbatim. They're verbatim. They're prompts, you know? Take it. I love Paul's just like, I'm so happy I'm back. This is a good time. And no, Paul, you're not still under anesthesia for your surgery. She's actually telling you the truth.
Oh, I am. Honestly, it was like a 440 record audit that I did in every single patient. And it was a specialty that either way, that would have been weird. Like, I'm not going to walk into that specialist's office and have either one of those done, regardless if I'm a him or her.
Yeah, exactly.
I discussed the patient's care with the patient and or family and or caregiver.
Yeah, and I get or that adult too. Child. I get that too. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. All right, Sean, what's next on the agenda?
So, you know, I was going to go to the E&M stuff, but since we are talking about these macros and everything, I want to share some guidance very quickly, and then we're going to move to the E&M stuff. We've talked about cloning on the Monday roundtable in the past. We've talked about it on the hashtag Terry Tuesdays. I've written articles about it. Prosecutors are looking at cloning in their pursuit of gaining convictions against providers. Cloning is a serious issue that you, as coders, as auditors, as practice administrators, as general counsel for health systems, hospital networks, external counsel for your physician practices, hospitals, health systems, you have got to educate your providers. Listen, CMS in the Program Integrity Manual actually states that cut and paste is appropriate in certain circumstances. But if it's routinely done, it devalues the work that was put into an encounter. And as such, it strips the claim of any medical necessity, because you don't know from cut and paste carrying forward what work was actually performed. Now, one of the arguments that I make is that depending on the specialty, when you have a chronic patient who a provider has been seeing for years, not much is going to change from visit to visit with that patient, especially somebody who is chronically ill, behavioral health issues, patients who are chronic pain management patients, oncology patients. So there's, again, when you look at a physical exam, I understand that there's only so many ways that you can say normal gait and station. There's only so many ways that you could say normal muscle tone. There's only so many ways that you could say oriented to person, place, and time. But to protect a provider from being accused of cloning, you have to make certain that the other portions of your medical record, where you can use language specific to today's encounter, to the questions that you are asking today, to the answers that you are getting today, make sure that those are distinguishable. For example, the chief complaint. The chief complaint, we all know, is a clear, concise statement for the reason of the encounter. It's always given or should be given in the patient's own words. But having a chief complaint that simply says F you, not that F you, but the follow-up F you. Having it simply say chief complaint F you is not a chief complaint. So have a clear, concise statement for the reason of the encounter. In the assessment and plan, right? Because under 21 and 23 guidelines, the applicability of the history and examination no longer is there. It just has to be a medically appropriate history and exam. Okay?
Hey, Sean. But, Sean?
Yes?
In your follow-up, how you said F or the FU, you know, whatever. There was an audit I did that was still written. It was recently, too, within the last year. Still written, and they had chief complaint, patient here for F/U. Well, yeah. I was doing this audit because the OIG felt that this practice was overcoding, and they sent a retired FBI agent to help with it. No medical, no auditing background, nothing. And I sat next to this person. They said that it was 100% that they failed. And I'm like, I'm only seeing about 18%. And they said, well, not everybody can be here for the flu. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they read it as F-L-U, not F/U. So I just thought that was interesting.
It doesn't shock me.
But you never know who your auditor is going to be.
That's right. So. Let me go back to the last part of what I was saying, and then I want to move on from there. But I just feel like, and obviously next week I'll be able to talk about this in more detail. But here's the last thing that I want to say. So we talked about having a clear, concise statement for the reason of the encounter. So we understand why the patient is here, okay? And it's always good to use terms like this patient who presents for follow-up of chronic whatever, okay? Because now you're laying the foundation. But in your assessment and plan is the other place where you can be very descriptive. You can give clear understanding for what transpired as an outcome of the historical gathering, as the examination component. Have in there not just continue meds as planned, but did you increase? Did you decrease? Did you discontinue? Did you start a new medication? I love when my providers, at the end of an encounter, and I do a ton of shadowing for providers, I love when at the end of a visit, my provider says to the patient, Mr. or Mrs. Patient, have I met your expectations today for this encounter? Have I given you an opportunity to ask questions, and have I answered those questions in a manner that you feel comfortable? And my providers will actually put that in there. Today, I discussed with the patient the following. I asked the patient if they were satisfied with my explanation. The patient said yes or no, and then give context. Folks, again, we're talking about history and exams that, because it's now medically appropriate, it's highly subjective. And to Terry's point, let me tell you something. And I want to put this out there for anyone who's listening, who's going to be an expert in a case, especially in a case where I'm working, you better daggum know what you're talking about. You better dot your I's, you better cross your T's, and you better know the Medicare benefit policy manual inside and out, and you better know the Medicare program integrity inside and out, because if you don't, I can assure you, during direct exam, I am going to make it clear that you are not somebody who should be listened to because you didn't get it right. Folks, I hate templates. I despise macros, especially where they're continuously dropped in on every single encounter. I understand templates are an evil necessity of electronic medical records, but you have got to adjust them in a manner that allows you to be able to demonstrate enough variance from encounter to encounter. Because, folks, I swear to you, these prosecutors are banging on the doors and using cloning and cutting and paste to make their case of intent to defraud under 18 U.S.C. 1347. All right, I'm going to stop, take a deep breath, because I'm still a little bit pissed off about some things. So, Christine, you come in with a cool, calm, and collected head and finish us off on this topic.
I want to address similarly to what you were saying, but maybe not to the expert. Let's talk to the biller. Let's talk on like Pam had said, let's talk about medical necessity. Even better, let's just talk about it in general. So do I still get paid if I just show up to work? Not going to do anything. I'm going to sit in a chair with my hands across my lap for 8 hours a day, do absolutely nothing, regardless where I'm at, in a medical office, in a retail, in a food service. I'm just going to sit in a room for 8 hours and expect to get paid. That would never fly, regardless of where you work. So let's go back to the visit. So a visit to give a patient normal blood results, that you're not going to change their plan of care. Why did they need to come in for a visit? Couldn't they have the phone? What about medications that do not require physiological monitoring, that we just refill for the patient? If they're just coming in for that, then what would be the reason for the visit, right? I think that it's important to remember that we can now use our medical assistants to help us create that history component, to talk to the patient about, tell me what's been going on since the last time that you were here, signs, symptoms, anything new in your life, any new problems that have presented themselves. Providers need to stop and educate those medical assistants that are gathering that information, but also when they come in to review it, reiterate that question. So since the last time I saw you, this is how the condition has been from that subjective perspective, not that everything is the same. What's the reason for the visit? It's again, it's like sitting in a chair for 8 hours or sitting in a chair. I'm here, pay me an hourly wage because of my presence. Patient encounters need to be medically necessary. They need to show that the doctor has done something today to evaluate that condition and to determine if the management that we're doing continues to be the same or do we need to change it. That's the whole premise of getting reimbursed for evaluation and management visits.
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point. And I think, you know, Pam mentioned in the comments about it drives me crazy when the chief complaint is med refills. And so some of this is just the nature and structure of how you're documenting notes. Are you evaluating the patients to determine, hey, since the last time I saw you 3 to 6 months ago or whenever that was, how has your condition changed? And you know, to tie together topics, I think that's a much better way to demonstrate longitudinal management of a patient than saying things like med refills. And the last thing I want to say, directed to Sean's point about copy and paste, you know, and again, I think this ties into some of the things I said before about the guidelines as they exist in the current state. I think, you know, there are a lot of providers who are flying a little close to the sun, as they say, or practices in general, in terms of how they're documenting under these guidelines, both in terms of the volume of copy and paste, particularly on the inpatient side. And it evokes that old argument about, well, the patient's condition hasn't changed, so I didn't change anything. I mean, I look at inpatient notes sometimes, and there is so much stuff carried forward that it's like going on an adventure, right? There are meds that have stopped and started, right? There's meds that have been like taken off the market. It's notes are so old. And then some of these macros about, you know, how many times in an inpatient note now do I see this macro that says, you know, I reviewed all of the imaging or reports below and discussed them with the patient. And there's no real thought put into that. And it triggers the internal auditor or coder to say, well, I'm just going to start to count whatever my provider said that he or she reviewed. And it, you know, I'm reading an ENT note last week, and the first thing, you know, I see the macro statement, I reviewed and discussed all these things with the patient. And the first thing I saw is like a foot x-ray. And it's, you know, and I'm, what's the groundwork? What's the justification for doing that? And of course, there's no discussion of this foot x-ray in the plan of care for this ENT, but it's sitting there in the note. And, you know, so the temptation internally, I'm sure, is to say, well, okay, my provider says that she reviewed these four things. None of them have any relevance to the overall condition. And so, you know, these guidelines, I think, are wonderful in many ways in terms of getting back to the sort of traditional soap note format. And I don't have to get clogged up with irrelevant family history and exam and all that. But I think in some respects, we're turning towards a new mechanism of counting that doesn't necessarily reflect the necessity of the work. And that includes the way these macros are carried forward and some pieces of documentation are carried forward. And I just wanted to put that out there, because when Sean was talking about those things, it's definitely reflective of things I see in the documentation that is concerning to me.
Yep, absolutely. All right. So I'm glad I was able to get some of that off my chest, and hopefully next week I'll be able to talk more about what it was. And man, I think when our listeners hear some of what transpired, you're just going to absolutely be mind boggled with the nonsense that took place last week. So anyways, all right, let's move on. And I think we only have one other topic, if I'm not mistaken, which is the change to evaluation and management service times. They've gone from times, time ranges. Oh yeah, we do have split shared services actually. So our time discussion should be a very quick one. Paul, do you want to talk about that? So in the 2024 guidelines, we've gone away from ranges and we've gone back to what?
You know, average total times. And where I'm concerned here, and these files have not yet been released because we are in that strange place where we have the final rule, and later this week we have the CPT AMA symposium for 2024 CPT changes, and it tends to roll out all of the RVU adjustments and for new codes and restructured RVUs for existing codes, where the time file for the final rule is not yet in place. And one thing that really concerns me is, with that range of time that we saw for CPT over the last 3 years for outpatient services, and in the last year for virtually every other place of service that we were dealing with, we saw more of a, it was a little bit more believable as far as those RVU time files and where they fell within those E&M ranges. I'm intimately knowledgeable of the physician time file under the physician final rule, and under the previous 2021 codes where everything was an average total time, there were wide variances of total time as CMS sees it for an E&M service than it did for a CPT code, and where that was to the point where level fours and level fives had a very wide variance. And it makes a difference if you're looking at a medically unbelievable day where suddenly everybody's billed at a four, but you didn't put in nearly the amount of office time to justify the number of fours based on average total time. So I'm looking forward to the release of that time file to see exactly where we are on that spectrum right now. But for 2023, it was a lot closer than what I expected to be for 2024.
Yeah. And the one thing that I want to say, and then we're going to move into our final topic with Terry on split shared services, the medically unbelievable day. I'm so glad that you brought that up for just a moment. Here's the thing. If a provider is going to be accused of a medically impossible or a medically unbelievable day, you can't simply run a study of times and use typical times, because you have to take into the account that they are averages. Some of these services are done faster. Some of these services take more time to do. But more importantly, who performed the service? Were they performed under Incident 2 services? Because if an ancillary support service member rendered the service, the physician still gets the RVU and the time credit for it. But here's the biggest flaw that is made when it comes to an impossible day and trying to prove it. Hear me out now. If you don't perform an audit of the documentation that's part of the allegation of a medically impossible day, you can't claim violation of the impossible day. Folks, it's a fatally flawed study without an actual chart audit, because they're typical times. Folks, think about this. And the last thing I'll say, we have a patient, okay? The patient is seen by three providers: Dr. Slow, Dr. Very Slow, and Dr. Fast. Is it fair that Dr. Fast gets paid less money than Dr. Slow or Dr. Very Slow because he or she was able to get it done in a quicker amount of time? They see the exact same patient, do the exact same history, examination, medical decision-making. Dr. Fast gets it done in 5 minutes. Dr. Slow, it takes 10 minutes. And Dr. Very Slow, it takes 20 minutes. Should Dr. Very Slow get paid more money because it took him or her 20 minutes to do something that Dr. Fast got it? Folks, you have to do a chart audit in order to be able to substantiate the findings of an impossible day. You can't accuse somebody of an impossible day if you don't understand incident two and if you've not done a chart audit. Okay, Terry Fletcher.
Yeah,
I'm giving it to you.
Thank you. I think I'm going to stick to this topic, and we can talk about some of the updates of CPT later, because I think there's some things that people may overlook in the time thresholds. So now it says you must meet or exceed time. Okay. And they say that in the hospital, which they came out with the 2023 guidelines that did change the range. It did talk about, instead of this range, it was meet or exceed. So now the office and other outpatient visits, office visits, and any visits now, you actually have to meet or exceed. Here's the thing that will change for those of you that bill prolonged services. So the level five for 2024, well, let me backtrack. Right now, the level five in 2023, there's Medicare and then there's non-Medicare. And so basically CPT says that once you hit the minimum time, you can add a prolonged care code 99417 or 418 if you're in the hospital to that patient, if they've just even as soon as they hit the minimum time, which makes no sense when you have a range. So when you have a time range that goes to 74 minutes, let's say 99205, 60 to 74 minutes, that wouldn't make sense if all that time includes in the level five. Well, now it says you have to meet or exceed, and it stops at 60 minutes. And underneath in parentheses, it says you add this once you've met that, you've met or again, meet that minimum time. So Medicare hasn't actually voiced an opinion on this, and we have a G code for prolonged care for Medicare. And I actually haven't checked yet to see if that's still there. But what's interesting is that that would basically negate Medicare's position that you have to hit the maximum time first, which they should. But that's what I think is going to make a really big difference, is that level five, or that highest valued code on the hospital side, to be able to add on that, that prolonged care, if that's what you're doing. Where there's going to be a problem, and I don't know what's going on, and I, you know, the panel, maybe you guys can talk about this, but this drives me crazy. We have this published guidance, and we see it in a lot of the transmittals, and it's usually buried, where Medicare says, CMS, Medicare, I'm using them interchangeably, that basically says, we are watching you when you use time, and you're saying that is how you are leveling your service, meaning that is going to be the low-hanging fruit. But here's where the problem lies with that, is that they include non-face-to-face time. And here, you know, hello macros again. And so this is where I think practices are finding that, like Sean had mentioned, that provable, unbelievable day, if that even makes sense. It's kind of a misnomer. But this is where that time factor, I hate it when people default to time, because that's such a problem. Somebody said, you know, how do you basically know what the maximum time, Pam did, how do you know the maximum time without the ranges? Well, remember, Pam, the prolonged service only goes in the highest value code. So the ranges are technically still there, because you can't get to a level three from a two until you hit meet the minimum time on a level three. So it's still technically there. But when you are in a level five, you just hit, if it's a new patient, 60 minutes. If it's a established patient, I think it's 40 minutes. I haven't looked yet. But basically, you just, level five is the only one you have to worry about. But where my concern is that I could see a lot of providers adding on these prolonged service codes. And by the way, I don't know any payer that pays for the patients or for the prolonged service codes for staff, where it says clinical staff, because I had a doctor saying, well, she's clinical. I said, where's her medical assistant, any kind of clinical certification? Says, doesn't say you have to have that. I'm like, oh my gosh, my face plant just got really big. My head hurts from all the face planting I'm doing. But this is what I was putting out to the panel, because I could go on for this forever, is why is CMS, why do they put so much trust in the process when they want to chase all the money for on audits? We every day we see OIG, every day we see UPIC and TPE and CERT audits, where there's something that's unusual going on, but they're putting so much trust. Look at the 2021 guidelines, whatever is appropriate, the physician thinks for exam and history. Look at the time thresholds. Well, you have to meet it, but will we also include non-face-to-face? You know, next time we'll talk about shared and split visits. Well, it just depends what you were collaborating with your staff with.
Terry, you've got two different organizations there. Think about that. You've got AMA that is giving us the code guidance. So AMA is advocating on the provider side. CMS is the payer side. So even though AMA is saying, hey, you know what, let's let the providers, you know, make the decision. What's medically appropriate? What does time look like? CMS is coming back and saying, whoa, wait a minute, but we're paying the bill here. So we want it to look like this. We're expecting it to be this. So again, we're respecting the fact that you're the provider of service, but wait a minute, we're paying that bill. So I think that's where the big breakdown is, Terry, is that AMA looks at it from that perspective of give the doctors the room they need to be doctors, and CMS is coming back in and saying, yeah, that's cool, but we're paying that bill. So we want to make sure that these following rules are followed, or these recommendations are followed, or guidances are followed.
And I also noticed that when commercial plans don't want to pay for something, they say, well, we go by Medicare guidelines, but not with everything, just with what they don't want to pay.
Yeah, it's pick and choose. All right. Well, I think we've done a thorough job of going through three of the four topics that we had on schedule today. Terry, we will start with split shared services on Monday next week. Listen, I gave you the floor with 15 minutes left, so you can't get mad at me that we didn't get to your topic today.
I think we need a half hour on that one.
Yeah.
I do too.
So... Yeah, absolutely. All right. So thank you to each and every single one of y'all who tuned in, logged on, and hung out with us for a little while today. Terry and I are going to be back tomorrow. I think we have an excellent topic. I can't wait to be able to talk about that one tomorrow for our hashtag Terry Tuesday. The whole crew, with the exception, I think, of Scott. Scott, are you going to be over in New Zealand next week?
I will be on a plane heading towards there, I think, at this time.
Okay. So Mr. Cerebral will not be with us, but we will have Terry, Stephanie, Christine, and Paul. So we will be back next Monday with our final episode prior to Thanksgiving. And then Terry and I will do our hashtag Terry Tuesday the day before Thanksgiving. So you could give thanks for Terry and I doing these segments for you. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all, be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media at The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.